This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to the Morning Run on BFM 89.9, the business station. I'm Melissa Idris with...
Brian Fernandez here.
He is bright and early chirpy, aren't you, this morning, Brian?
Well, you know me. I'm a sunshine.
Actually, you have a really good energy in the morning. You're you have the most energy of all of us in the Morning Run when you come in the morning. And it's always this wonderful bundle of energy that comes rushing through the door. Good morning. Good morning. And it's wonderful to be
That's
around.
That's a good thing. And I hope you as listeners, that translates out to the airwaves.
I hope so, too. Well, let's kick off the show today. 6 o'clock on Tuesday, the 20th. 6th of September. Let's take a look at the news coming out overnight. North Korea's foreign minister has accused US President Donald Trump of declaring war on his country. This is North Korea, of course. So really quite, I think, an escalation of the war of words that happened over the weekend, not just at the UN General Assembly, but also on Twitter, thanks to Donald Trump calling Kim Jong-un the rocket man. And I think there was, kind of back and forth on this. So the North Korean foreign minister has now said that Pyongyang has the right to shoot down US bombers. And this could even apply if the warplanes are not in North Korean airspace.
So again, you could look at this as just saber rattling and North Korea doing the North Korea.
Are you worried, Brian, that this could escalate?
Okay, strangely enough, not. And I think even the financial markets are not that worried. They've kind of priced this because North Korea has played this out time and time again.
Okay, so it's in your mind, it's more like fiery talk and not really something
Absolutely.
That will escalate
so
to war.
Saber rattling, they want concessions, they don't want to back down, but I think this will pass.
Okay, well, in the US, in retaliation to this, Donald Trump has expanded his controversial travel ban to include people from North Korea, Venezuela and Chad. And he cited security concerns for this. Iran, Syria, Libya, Yemen and Somalia remain under this travel ban that he put out. If you remember, the sanctions against Sudan that were previously placed has been lifted. Moving on, we have news locally that prominent Turkish journalist Mustafa Akyol has been detained at KLIA on the way to fly out of the country. He had been invited to speak at a lecture on Islam and was summoned by the Federal Territories Islamic Affairs Department, or JAWI.
So the very disappointing turn of events. He was supposed to speak at an event in Nottingham
yes,
University.
Yeah.
It's hard to see why he was arrested in the first place.
I didn't know that JAWI's authority or jurisdiction covered international speakers. So this is quite interesting.
Yeah, and the challenge with this is that there could be definitely a backlash from Turkey itself as a result of this. So areas of concern, obviously, for us, as you mentioned, who really has jurisdiction over
exactly.
this matter?
Yep. And a quick look at a new image taken by a US government satellite that millions of people in Puerto Rico remain without electricity in the wake of Hurricane Maria. Outside the capital city of San Juan, residents are still isolated without power or communications, and officials are warning that it could take months to restore.
And a point to note is the fact that Puerto Rico is part of the United States.
Exactly. And you know what was funny, Brian? In the past few days, President Donald Trump has been tweeting about the NFL, kerfuffle or controversy, shall we say, taking the knee controversy, as opposed to really talking about Puerto Rico, which is part of the US.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I need to highlight is the fact that Puerto Rico actually has a debt of $72 billion and is facing the largest bankruptcy case in the U.S.
So you mean the efforts to rebuild could be a
problem? No, it's existing debt. So in other words, this compounds an already bad situation.
Understood. Yeah, we could be looking at a humanitarian crisis in the U.S. It's 5 minutes past 6 o'clock. In just a few more minutes, we're going to be taking a look at why you shouldn't imitate Bill Gates if you want to be rich. Yes, really. We'll tell you more after this on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, good morning. This is The Morning Run and you're with me, Melissa Idris and Brian Fernandez. That was Mama Told Me Not to Come by Three Dog Night. 9 minutes past 6 o'clock and we're looking at the the idea that exceptional performers are the most skilled or talented, and that's the kind of pervasive narrative, right? However, this narrative is flawed because top performers' success may have to do more with great timing rather than great talent. And this according to a professor of strategy and behavioral science at Warwick University.
So he argues that basically top performers are often the luckiest people who have benefited from being at the right place at the right time. And they are what we call outliers, whose performance may set them apart from others. He used Bill Gates as a very specific example. We often think of Bill Gates as this high school dropout dropout from Harvard that went on to be a big success. But the reality is this: he had an upper class background, he had a private education, he had access to computer programming with less than 0.01% of his population of his generation had access to computers at the time. His mom also was connected to the IBM's chairman.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Absolutely. So that then helped him get the deal with later that Microsoft provided the software for the IBM PC. So in other words, yes, he is an exceptionally bright individual. He is exceptionally talented, focused, and so forth. But with all those elements, he had that extra element to make him that extraordinary success. So talent and effort, so the article argues, perhaps is less important than people think because luck plays a very big role in it as well.
Yes, I do see that, and I can see where luck and timing comes into it, but I really wouldn't discount the two very distinct skills of characteristics of not just talent but skill, right? So you and hard work, right? So for instance, I mean, the narrative is that hard work can make you successful, can get you where you want to be and achieve your dreams. You just have to work hard at it. And what you're saying is, no matter how hard you work, if you don't have a lucky break, if you don't hit that right timing, it all is for naught.
Okay, so let's take an example of, say, the corporate world, for example. And let's use an example, very generic example of an accounting firm. Now, people go through the mill, they join in as audit, say for example, audit assistants.
And then you pay your dues and
hard work. But many people stagnate at a level known as senior manager. So it's one level below partner. And within the partnership framework, that's when the big bucks come in. Now, a lot of times, unless you've had the right guidance through your years, some people make partners maybe at 34. Some people make partner at 44.
Oh, what do you mean by the right guidance?
So, again, a lot of and this has been shared by friends that I know who are partners, for example. A lot of times, mentoring pays a big role. Somebody's taken an eye on you. Somebody's seen something special with you, and they help you along the way. And one of my friends blatantly told me, he said, you know, if that person didn't notice me, I wouldn't have made partner so quickly. I was just as hardworking, just as smart. I had some different elements in terms of personality, but I think that really helped me make partner early.
But, you know, that's a really kind of controversial stand, because what about, you know, doing it yourself, kind of fighting the good fight and putting in the hard work and not relying on someone to give you favors for you to achieve success?
So, but just look at business success, for example. So a lot of times, and I'll use the Formula One example of Sir Frank Williams, who runs the Williams Formula One team. Now, Sir Frank was a miserable failure, back of the grid team for many, many years before he was Sir Frank, until he met a guy called Patrick Head. And Patrick Head is his number two, who's a co-owner of the Williams team. I think now he's divested his shares. But basically, after Patrick Head came in, luck, and he says this, luck played a big part in their meeting, and luck subsequent to that, business just took off. The team became a performer financially as well as on track.
Okay, so give me some tips on how I can increase the chances of luck being on my side.
Well, there's no shortage for working hard, working smart, and these are all cliches.
And being ready for when luck strikes, right?
Absolutely. You've got to be prepared.
Okay, it's 6:14 right now. And after this, we're going to ask the question whether you have a duty of care to rescue someone in danger. Well, according to German law, you do. Details after this on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, 6:19 right now. Melissa and Brian here with you on The Morning Run. That was The Stars Are Out Tonight by David Bowie. A German court has convicted three individuals for failure to provide assistance to an elderly man who had collapsed at an ATM machine at a bank. Now, what happened was security footage showed that the 83-year-old man had fallen and had hit his head on the tiles. And this was about 5 p.m. on a national public holiday. So the four people that entered subsequently to withdraw money into this kind of vestibule had seen him lying on the ground and stepped over him to withdraw cash. It was only the fifth person, Brian, who went to check on this poor man. And that was 20 minutes later that he received medical assistance and called an ambulance. So by that time, he had died. The man had died.
So the arguments from the defendants was really that homeless people often took shelter in the bank
area.
They thought
he was homeless.
Absolutely. So they thought he was homeless, but they had the duty of care there. Why didn't they check?
Well, okay. So under German law, failure to respond to a medical emergency is punishable by a fine or up to a year in jail. And people are required to at least alert emergency services if they don't have first aid skills themselves. So what happened was, The judge in court had found several women guilty and imposed a fine of about 3,600 euros, which is quite a significant amount for not helping this man. And the argument is, if you had helped him, he could possibly be still alive.
Yeah. In a place like Germany, we have law. I mean, they have laws like that. But how about in Malaysia? Mm. How do you think this thing would have played out in Malaysia?
Well, I don't know. And that bodes the question, right, of whether you have a duty of care to rescue someone in danger. In Malaysia, there's the argument that you are putting yourself at personal risk if you do help someone. And we've seen all these, you know, I don't know whether they're fraudulent messages that go online to say that, oh, don't if someone hits the back of your car, don't get out to help an injured person or to see the accident because you yourself could be mugged. And it puts the fear of helping others in you. And I have to say this, that it really is a moment of kind of, you have to have the mental clarity and fortitude at that moment where you see something happen and decide what to do. I remember I was in Australia, I was in Sydney, and I was walking home from university, and the lady next to me was walking next to me, somehow tripped. She's an elderly lady, and I think she lost her balance. She tripped on the footpath and the pavement and fell and literally cracked her head open. Like she
oh dear.
Yeah, she had a head wound and she was bleeding, and happened right next to me. And I mean, I was 25, I think, and I was trying to figure out what to do. But I called an ambulance and stayed with her. And before you know it, you've been dragged into this kind of case of, you know, with medical insurance and trying to call family members. And you're the innocent bystander who is suddenly drawn into this case. And because she was an Asian lady, they assumed I was family. So again, I suddenly became next of kin. But really, it does take you by surprise. And I think all you have to do is kind of just say, well, what if this was my mother? What if this was my aunt? Wouldn't you want someone to help your family members if it had happened to them?
So, okay, on the flip side of the equation, the other reaction could be, and let me paint you a scenario. You see a homeless person on the side of the road, sleeping, but maybe looking like he's in discomfort. You've got your two kids with you. What do you do then? So the challenge is, so I know I would react potentially very differently. If I had a child or two with me, I would be very wary of intervening because of the potential danger.
Sure.
Now, if I was alone, I would more likely than not go and check and see whether or not that person was okay. And that's the dilemma, I think, because you don't want to put your loved ones in harm's way. And if we look at a China example, for example, people avoid it because you are responsible.
Ah, yes. And not just in China, in India as well. You somehow get caught up in the legal battle and someone can sue you for...
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's right.
So because of that, unfortunately, society has taken a different route And in terms of not helping, and that really hardens you, I think, as a person, well, as an individual.
When I read this story, Brian, I have to say the first thing that I that popped into my mind was the Princess Diana crash in 1997, when the paparazzi chasing her car had maybe even caused the crash. They, instead of helping her, stood around and took photographs of her. And I remember thinking, and I remember as a child thinking to myself, well, that can't be right. You know, and
absolutely.
that really kind of, I think that was a really kind of warped view of what was more important in that point of time. So there you go. I mean, it really is quite a difficult question. And I think in Malaysia, many people will answer this question differently, whether you have a duty of care to stop and help someone in danger, even if you don't know what that means for yourself.
Yeah, because the thing is, we don't have any legislation. This is a grey area, obviously, for us. It's not as clear-cut as in Germany. And I, unfortunately, as sad as it sounds, I think in urban settings, if we see a very dirty person lying, we would probably just walk past. We probably wouldn't be compassionate.
We're conditioned.
Yes, it's a conditioning. That way. Mm-hmm. If that person, however, is a well-dressed man in a suit, and looking very handsome, someone will probably, and he collapsed suddenly, more likely than not, I believe, someone will go out and help him.
It's coming up to 6:30 and we've got the news bulletin in just about 5 minutes. But first, here's Crimson and Clover by Tommy James and the Shondells on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, driving by the Kinks there. Good morning. I'm Melissa Idris with Brian Fernandez. 6:39 on the clock. And a self-service laundromat in Mua has sparked controversy on social media. Why? Because it caters only to Muslim patrons. Now, photographs of the sign have gone viral and netizens, of course, are divided in their opinion. Some have praised the move, saying that it was done for the benefit of Muslim customers. Given concerns that there was a possibility of a mixture of najis or impurities in the wash loads, and on the other hand, others have criticized it for being unfair.
Yeah, so just to give you a sample of the comments, Zachary Ashard, a Facebook user, said he was disappointed that what the laundromat was doing was actually dividing the community. On the other hand, Suresh Pandian said, if the owner is a Muslim and wants to run it a Muslim way, I don't think there's anything wrong with it. That's his right. So obviously we have divided opinions on whether this is right or not wrong. But however, religious authorities, however, believe that the owner is acting within his rights. So the Johor Islamic Religious Affairs Committee chairman told NST that there's nothing wrong with the owner of the laundromat to impose these rules and regulations.
Okay, I don't know whether that I agree with that. Okay, maybe there's nothing legally preventing someone from opening this. If he sees a market for it, then you know that's his prerogative. But I do feel that this, and if compounded with all the other cases that we've seen recently with the Better Beer Festival and that segregation of cups that happened in schools, all this just kind of feels like a narrowing of space for non-Muslims living in this country. It also feels like a narrowing of space of discussion in terms of the role of religion in public life.
I think also, unfortunately, this narrowing of space is also in electioneering. Elections around the corner. So
do you think so? Do you think that every time elections come around, that in the lead up to it, there's always this kind of ratcheting up of, you know,
religious
sentiments, issues and racial issues?
Because I think deep down Malaysians really are a cohesive lot. They want to be tolerant. You have obviously the outliers who are not and who are extremists. But it's good that, for example, senior prominent people like Nazir Raza and the Johor Prince have come out against this practice.
Yep. So the Johor Prince had commented on Instagram. So TMJ said that, questioned, is this for real? This is too extreme. I'm appalled, he says. And Nazir Razak says, this is very troubling. We have to curb such extremism if we are to build a peaceful and progressive multicultural Malaysia. This must be a misinterpretation of Islamic teaching. Now, the question I also have to bring up is whether this feels like it's happening more simply because there's a medium to share it, right? Because of social media, because of the fact that these photos can become viral, we're now more aware of it, despite this perhaps happening most of the time around the country.
Yes, and again, social media has played a big role in amplifying all these arguments, whether for or against. But let me also take a different perspective now. Let's take the business person's perspective. Now, in this case, this laundromat perhaps sees a business opportunity of catering to a very large market, which is the Muslim market. So it's 70% of the market, 60-70% of the market, could be even more in his or her constituency, and says, hey, if I do this, I'm going to attract a lot more customers than I was just any other laundromat.
But that's in the presumption that there is a case to be made of separating your clothes from a non-Muslim's clothes. I don't profess to be an expert in Islam, but I don't think that there's anything there to say that I can't touch you because of, you know, I can't mix my clothes with you because of impurities. I can't drink the same cup as you because you're non-Muslim. I don't think that there's
Correct.
Anything there.
No, I agree with you, but I'm trying to see the different point of view. And let's take an example. Because this is in Muar, so it's probably not a main city centre in Malaysia.
You can say that because you're from Johor, right?
Yes, yes, I'm from Johor Bahru, you know. So Johor Bahru is a main city centre. Muar is perhaps a smaller a town in Johor, and people's views may be different. And this business owner may have heard it from his friends or colleagues and so forth and said, hey, there's a big business opportunity here. If I only cater to Muslim patrons, people who are not comfortable sending their clothes outside will send it to me and I'm going to be very, very successful. So I'm trying to just see perhaps even the person's views may not, in terms of running the business, may be very different from his personal
Well,
views.
I respect you for trying to see the business owner's point of view, but as a Muslim Malaysian, I'm worried about what this represents in terms of the Islam, the growing Islamism within the country. But, you know, I mean, to each his own. I'd love to hear what you guys think. Please WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. That's 018-789-8899. Tell us where you fall on the issue of this Muslim-only laundromat. I mean, what do you think this represents, and whether or not the business owner had a prerogative to do that to cater to what he saw as a gap in the market? It's coming up to 6:45 right now. And after this, we're going to be looking at why Malaysia has disagreed with ASEAN's stand on the Rohingya crisis. What does this mean for our role in ASEAN? Stay tuned to find out on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Love Bug Blues by Charles Bradley. 6:50 on the clock. It's now, you're listening to The Morning Run on Tuesday, the 26th of September, with me, Melissa Idris, and Brian Fernandez this morning. Malaysia is disassociating itself from an ASEAN statement on the Rohingya crisis. Now, in a strongly worded statement, Wisma Putra has told Myanmar to end the violence against the Rohingyas there. And what we wanted to do was find out more about the inner workings of ASEAN. So we spoke to Bun Negara, Senior Fellow at the Institute of Strategic and International Studies, or otherwise known as ISIS Malaysia. And we asked Bun what happens when a member country goes against the group's consensus rule.
Well, I wouldn't say it goes against it. It's just that, to my knowledge, Malaysia's position is that it wants to make the statement stronger. But since, it has not happened in the chairman's statement, Malaysia gives value added to it. It's not as if the ASEAN chairman's statement is not condemning the violence. It does do that. The problem with official ASEAN documents is that it always tends to say as little as possible in order to imply having to do even less. So that is, the ASEAN formula of unfortunately catering to the lowest common denominator. In this case, Malaysia feels that the urgency of the situation on the ground is so intense that, stronger words need to be added. So Malaysia is giving value added to it rather than going against it, as some headlines tend to say.
We also asked Bun Negara to elaborate on the ASEAN minus X formula of the ASEAN Charter and whether there is built-in flexibility for member states to have a say beyond consensus statements.
Well, the ASEAN minus X formula basically says that any ASEAN member country may proceed and do whatever it feels is necessary, sometimes even with a non-ASEAN party, so long as it does not contradict ASEAN's fundamentals. And, you know, this is basically what can be described as the situation now. The ASEAN chairman's statement serves as a basis for Malaysia's added statements to highlight what is necessary and keep a sharper focus on the needs that prevail in Myanmar right now.
Finally, we asked him if this statement will hold any bearing on what's going on in Myanmar now. I mean, does it even hold any weight?
Well, you see, by being such a weak statement, the ASEAN position, such as it is, if it is a position at all, doesn't say very much. So anything that adds to it would presumably give further value to it as well. So let's see what happens. Because, you know, the less that is said about the violence in Myanmar, the worse it's likely to become. So if there is more that can be said and should be said, then it would add to international pressure to the party in Myanmar that would have the greatest responsibility and capability in doing something positive to stop the violence, and that party is the Myanmar government.
That was Bun Negara, Senior Fellow at ISIS, or the Institute of Strategic and International Studies. Now, the ASEAN statement, Brian, is often issued by a consensus, but this statement that Bun was referring to is issued by the current chair of ASEAN, which is the Philippines. So this statement didn't actually name the Rohingyas, although it did appeal to all sides to avoid action that would worsen the situation. So I think very much to his point that perhaps ASEAN documents really tend to say as little as possible to imply, you know, having to do less, as Bun said it, as having to do less, right? So you really cater to the lowest common denominator. Yeah,
it was very strongly worded in his sense. But then again, that's the ASEAN way. It's about getting consensus and doing things in a non-confrontational manner. So this is one the Myanmar issue is in this case is one of the rare occasions where Malaysia, for example, has broken ranks. But we must look back also in terms of bringing even Myanmar to the fold. Malaysia was a key driver in integrating Myanmar into ASEAN and then also then later into the international community.
Yeah, so which is why it does seem like a strong position to take that Malaysia is the only member country that's disassociating itself from the statement that's issued by Consensus ASEAN. I do agree with Bun that this matter is, and I do agree with Wisma Putra in taking this stand, that this matter is far too serious to issue lukewarm statements, and you really do need to take a stand rather than sit by and have this non-interfering stance.
Yeah, Melissa, in this case as well, I'm in full agreement. You know, hats off to Wisma Putra for taking a strong stand because we need to take action.
We need even an even stronger stand, Brian.
Yeah, absolutely.
Definitely
and
an even
take
stronger
action
stand.
Against to assist all the refugees and the atrocities in Myanmar at the moment.
6:55 right now. We've got news coming up at the top of the hour. But first, the Counting Crows with Accidentally in Love on BFM 89.9. Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9, the business station. Coming up, we've got a whole load of interviews and news in this next hour. I'm Melissa Idris with Brian Fernandez, and we're going to catch you up on all that news. We're going to be looking at the local papers and how they framed the news of the day, including why a renowned Turkish author was stopped by religious authorities on the way out, leaving the country. And on Market Watch today, we have U.S. analyst Joe Quinlan joining us on the line to take a look into Trump's tax plan. All this coming up in the next hour on the Morning Run. But first, the government has announced that it will provide special additional assistance to Orang Asli students who are pursuing tertiary education. The Prime Minister, Dato' Sri Najib Razak, said that the one-off aid will be announced during the tabling of Budget 2018 next month. So on the surface of it, the aid for tertiary education for Orang Asli students, it's a great idea. And so we spoke to Yusri Ahon, president of JOAS, which stands for Jaringan Orang Asal Semalaysia, or the Indigenous Peoples Network of Malaysia. Our conversation with him was in Bahasa Malaysia. And what we did was we asked him on his views of the financial aid that was announced by the government.
peruntukan tu dia haskan dia one off untuk melanjutkan pendidikan kan. Tapi memang cabarannya banyaklah. Jadi peruntukan tu kalau dia menyediakan di peringkat high level lah, contohnya untuk ke universiti, tetapi kalau peringkat permulaan dia tidak cukup atau tidak difahami, bagi saya ini adalah satu isu lah kepada orang asli untuk mencapai tahap pendidikan yang sangat baik. Contohnya sekarang ni macam di negeri Kelantan, dia untuk menghantar kanak-kanak ke sekolah pun sudah ada cabaran. Contohnya, bila menghantar kanak-kanak ke sekolah dengan jalannya yang tidak begitu baik, bergantung jalan pada jalan pembalak. Sedangkan orang kampung tak suka dengan pembalak, tetapi terpaksa ada setengahnya terima pembalakan kerana mahu jalan mereka agak baik sedikit. Dan bila sampai di sekolah, mereka tidak mendapat pendidikan secukupnya. Sebab contohnya macam di sekolah Bihai, guru-guru yang mengajar di sekolah itu hanya bertugas 3 hari saja dalam masa seminggu. Dan walaupun contohnya mereka ada berminat untuk belajar, untuk mengubah mereka, tetapi kadang-kadang walaupun mereka dah sudah sampai lah, tapi di sekolah pun ada cabaran-cabarannya lagi. Contohnya sebab guru-guru tadi bermasalah, ataupun warden pun ada, kadang-kadang ada bermasalah. Contoh di sekolah Puspiah, ada warden-warden yang memaksa kanak-kanak, bila mereka merasa marah kepada kanak-kanak tersebut, mereka suruh kanak-kanak itu menelan kaca. Dan ini bagi saya satu tindakan yang tidak bermoral lah.
So if I could paraphrase what he said, now he pointed out that it's a one-off aid. This announcement will be a one-off aid to pursue higher education. But one of the key issues faced by the Orang Asli community is the challenges in even completing basic education. So he cited examples of the logistical struggles that the Orang Asli face to send their kids to schools. So for instance, the poor roads that they have to go through. He also related some stories of mistreatment by teachers at the schools, where some schools teachers are only on duty 3 days a week. So even if there is real interest among Orang Asli students to learn and to improve, the educational environment and the teachers themselves may not help. So we understand that the financial aid will be distributed by the government's department overseeing Orang Asli issues, which is the Jabatan Kemajuan Orang Asli, or JECOA. And so we asked him of his views on the perception of JECOA among the Orang Asli communities and what the government should do to achieve the aim.
Yeah. Bagi saya, kalau betul-betul kerajaan mempunyai niat yang baik untuk meningkatkan pendidikan masyarakat Orang Asli, kerajaan perlu mengadakan satu perbincangan dengan NGO-NGO Orang Asli, terutama dengan JOS, dengan JECOSERV ataupun dengan JECOP, bukan saja dengan JECOA. Sebab NGO-NGO ini yang amat prihatin kepada Orang Asli buat masa inilah. Sebab dengan NGO-NGO Orang Asli, perbincangan dengan NGO-NGO Orang Asli ini, kita akan dapat memberi pandangan-pandangan kita lah. Contohnya, mungkin kita perlu mengubah sistem, bukan mengubah sistem pendidikan, tetapi cara mendidik. Contohnya, kita mungkin membina satu pusat untuk mendidik anak-anak Orang Asli di peringkat bawahan. Contohnya, melalui bahasa imuda, ataupun kita melihat daripada sudut bagaimana mengatasi keciciran masyarakat Orang Asli. Sebab apa yang mereka lihat sekarang ini adalah daripada luar, bukan mereka melihat daripada dalaman. Mereka tidak memahami apa yang melanda masyarakat Orang Asli.
That was Yusri Ahun, president of JOAS, or Jaringan Orang Asal Semalaysia, speaking on behalf of the NGO. Now, what he said was essentially the government should engage with a range of civil society actors, not just JECOA, and maybe we need to change the way we educate Orang Asli children by perhaps using their mother tongue, for example. And according to Yusri, the government perhaps sees things from the outside and not from within the community itself.
I think, you know, Melissa, this is part of a bigger problem. We really have not looked after our indigenous people well enough. It's literally looking at it from a perspective of tertiary education. And I totally agree with him. It's totally the wrong approach, because really we need to focus on getting them to school, getting them up the educational rank, and therefore being more employable. It's so difficult to... Poverty eradication, and this is a proven thing in many, many countries, education is the vehicle for poverty eradication. Unfortunately, too many, too large segments of our Orang Asli population are really living in poverty still.
Yeah, so I do agree with Yusri saying that, you know, I mean, if you can't even get the basic education level right, what hope do they have of, you know, tertiary education? So a one-off special aid from Budget 2018 may not have the impact that the government is hoping to see. Rather, what Yusri Ahon is saying from JAWS is that perhaps look at the fundamental issues, right? Look at the basic problems that parents have in sending their kids to school, the infrastructure of schools, the teaching community in Orang Asli communities. So all this, I think, you know, you can kind of juxtapose that against a country like New Zealand, for example, where indigenous communities have a political voice. They have political representation.
And if you look at people like Australia as well, the indigenous people have made great... They, like us, did not treat their indigenous people well enough. But since the 70s, they have made great strides in improving basic education and infrastructure at indigenous communities. And as a result, for example, they even have indigenous Aboriginals who have made it up the corporate ranks. And also, our previous First Secretary in the Australian High Commission many years ago, today is an ambassador for Australia, and he's part Aboriginal as well.
Yeah, and we also have, I think, Wetex Kang, who was born in Malaysia and immigrated to Australia and then later to New Zealand, and he is looking to collaborate with the Maori Party in New Zealand, which is trying to work with the ethnic Chinese community in that country. So really, you can see the difference of how policy and government treat indigenous communities elsewhere. Perhaps that's something we can learn from here in Malaysia. It's coming up to 7:15 in just a couple of minutes. We'll take a look at the front pages of today's papers. Stick with The Morning Run on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.